Support for WPR comes from the Stevens Point area, offering a variety of getaway experiences, itineraries and ideas for beer lovers, foodies, outdoor recreation fans, and more are at StevensPointArea.com.
It's easy to assume that everything is fine with your pet, but like they say, an ounce of prevention can be worth a pound of cure. And when it comes to preventing obesity, we mean that literally. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine takes time every month to spend some time with us to give us advice on keeping our pets healthy and happy. And Dr. Sandy, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
There's some good news for pet owners who want to have a much better idea of what their pets are eating.
And yeah.
Pet food and treat manufacturers, they're finally being required to put calorie content?
You got it. In a usable form. So many of them will put it on, like, how many kilocalories per kilogram of food? Well, how many people have a kitchen scale? Or, you know, and you're taking that little single cat treat, you know. So for treats, it's going to be as an individual. But for food, it's going to be in usable measurements with cups. You know, and I think it's really important because last year, there's this website that I absolutely love. I probably go on it at least daily, if not more, to look at how many calories are in different foods and so on. And it's called the Pet Obesity Prevention website, petobesityprevention.com. And in their study that they did, they just, this is what's been reported, 58.3% of cats are overweight in the United States, and 52.2% of dogs are overweight. So over half of our pet population is now classified as overweight or obese. But, I know that it's been required for a long time to put the calorie content on human food, and that has not changed our level of obesity in the world
no,
either.
It hasn't.
So, one, you got to read the label. Two, you have to know how many calories your pet should eat. And this would be something that, although there are guidelines published for certain sizes of dogs, it is something your veterinarian could calculate out for you. So when you go in, ask them to do a calorie assessment need. And that way you can turn it around and say, here's how much food I need to feed my pet. But even with that, sometimes we have to tweak diets. Cats in particular, they may be on the right number of calories, but just aren't losing weight. And all we do is just change where those calories are coming from. Go to a high protein, low fat, low carb food, the Katkins diet, and they sometimes start losing weight because it affects their metabolism. So there's lots that we can do for these pets, but it's really important to take it seriously because you want your pets to live a long time and be healthy. And, just like in humans, it's linked to so many things, diabetes, joint disease, even living less, 15% less.
Oh, and you start thinking about, okay, we've got, as you well know, you see both of our cats, two cats, the activity levels of those cats are different, a little bit difference in age. So you have to, I assume, take that sort of thing into account, too.
Yeah. The average number of cats in an American household is 2.1. And many people have, obviously, more, if that's the number. But and people, especially with cats, like to just leave the food down all the time. And if you interviewed cats and they could tell us, hey, this is how I want to eat, they would like to eat probably on average about a dozen little meals a day. Sometimes those little meals turn into bigger meals, and that's why we end up seeing a problem with obesity. But, I think it comes down to pets need to be treated as an individual, fed separately, monitored separately. You just can't have a one-size-fits-all diet for everybody.
And do they have guidelines as to how many calories a day might come from treats as opposed to?
That's something we can figure out when we're doing this. I mean, obviously, you want to make sure that at least 90% of their diet is coming from a well-balanced food. But, adding in that little extra 10% of treats, and many treats do have functional properties, like things like the Greenies cat treats have been approved by the Veterinary Oral Health Council as showing that they're helpful for getting rid of plaque and tartar on the teeth. But when you read the fine print on the bag, I'm probably exaggerating, but it seemed like it was like half a bag a day to be able to have some significant effects. So, treats are there primarily to show your love and maybe have some function. But I think that's a hidden area where, some of those dog treats are just so high in calories. I'm just grateful that this is going to be an eye-opener for everybody.
Yeah, and treats for cats, we never give the cat's treats?
Oh, I have something. I don't know what I've got. They're just some like Temptations or Pounce treats or whatever. And it's still nice to have them come running and get a little piece of food. So, yeah. Well, and it shows our love.
I'm wondering about canned tuna. I've heard that can be a problem.
You know, and it's a kind of an interesting correlation. Well, first of all, if you just asked me a couple of weeks ago about canned human tuna, I would have probably said, oh, a flake or two now and then, not a big deal. Problem with using it as the whole diet is it's not balanced. It's all fish. It doesn't have the right levels of antioxidant vitamins and so on. It's meant to be part of our well-balanced diet, not a cat's whole diet. But what this study was, and I'm going to have to kind of go backwards here a little bit. It was looking at environmental and lifestyle risk factors for cats that would develop oral cancer. The most common kind of oral cancer that cats get are called squamous cell carcinoma. Horrible cancer, almost always fatal, rarely ever successfully treated. And it accounts for oral cancer is about the fourth leading cause of cancer in cats. So it's something that we do see fairly commonly as cats get older. And one of the things that we saw is, people know, smoking, the cats being exposed to all those carcinogens and they're grooming them off their hair coat. And what they found for people that smoke is that, if with a smoker, it had a twofold increase in squamous cell carcinoma, which I thought, you're going to see more, not surprising. Guess what they found for cats that were eating tuna, even as just a supplemental part of their diet? It was a 5 times increase in the squamous cell carcinoma.
Goodness.
Why? I have no idea. Is it having to do with mercury in the fish? Is it some other chemicals that, they are absorbing through the food chain? I don't know. And so this is something, obviously, more research is going to have to be done. So right now I'm telling people, avoid tuna, especially, the human tuna if you can. And even maybe tuna cat food, just to play it safe until we get some more answers.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest. Lots of callers online, Sandy. So let's go to Jeff in Fond du Lac. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi there. Thanks for taking my call. There's been a recent bout of kennel cough that has kind of worked its way through the neighborhood, through a bunch of the neighborhood dogs that are primarily all hunting dogs. And I'm curious if it's something that they've all seemed to have gotten over it at this point, but I'm curious if it's something that they could still be passing to each other. Can you just pass it back and forth, or do they develop an immunity to that strain or to all strains? Or I guess how does that work?
Well, kennel cough is a complex, and it is made up of a number of things, everything from bacteria such as Bordetella, which is the classic form of kennel cough, or tracheitis is what we're dealing with, to some viruses and other organisms, mycoplasma and so on. So there's a number of different things in that complex that can cause it. So when people say, well, my dog's been vaccinated for kennel cough, why are you telling me my dog has kennel cough? It's because we don't vaccinate for everything. And unless you start doing some tracheal washes and cultures and virus isolation, you may not know exactly what the organism is that's going from dog to dog. So when we have diagnosed kennel cough, the important thing is that they need to be kept isolated from other dogs for at least a couple of weeks, because anytime they're coughing, they're aerosolizing those bugs and another susceptible dog could be put at risk. So I'm sorry you're running into trouble with that. We've been seeing a few cases here in Madison as well. And one of the things that I'm always kind of on the lookout for is so far have not identified a huge risk in Wisconsin for canine influenza, not to be confused with parainfluenza, which is one of the kennel cough type bugs, but it's influenza, like our influenza, and they can present with coughing. It's different than the typical cough. They usually run a fever and have lung signs and are feeling pretty down and out. But it could be confusing if you've got a dog that's pretty sick with just your routine kennel cough as well. So I think this is something, having your veterinarian have a look at your dog, get their temperature, listen to their lungs to make sure the lungs sound clear. And again, this is kind of a bugaboo for us as well. Just as I was leaving, I had an urgent message left that I passed on to my technician. Somebody called and said their dog's just coughing like crazy. we need to see that dog, but how do you get them into the clinic without going through the waiting room and having them cough on other dogs? So we have the owners stay outside, call us, we bring them in a back door, then we isolate them in a room, they don't see any other dogs, and then that room is you know, stripped down and disinfected so that we don't have another patient coming in contact with it. So, yeah, I'd say if your dog's feeling down and out, get them checked out.
Yeah, good luck, Jeff. Thank you for calling. Linnea in Washburn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you so much for this program. I adopted a six-year-old lab mix from our shelter, and he has a skin condition that I haven't succeeded in treating well. It's large patches of inflamed, dry, flaking skin, and it's kind of heartbreaking to see how inflamed it is.
Mm-hmm.
So I've taken him into the vet. They've given antibiotics as well as a cortisone shot to bring down the swelling, and I've done that maybe three cycles, and every 2-3 months it gets so inflamed he goes back. I was wondering if you could recommend a medication that might keep the symptoms under control, or a food diet that would be more appropriate. He's currently on a lamb rice diet.
Okay. Skin allergies or allergies in dogs is probably one of the leading things that we see. About 1 in 5 dogs is affected with seasonal allergies. And so I'm going to just give you kind of some of the things that I do that, you know, hopefully will help decrease some of the symptoms and help prevent the dog from getting worse. Number one is obviously treating the secondary infections. The skin is a wonderful, wonderful barrier. It is so good. I mean, I could put my hand, if I didn't have any cuts or scratches, in some bacteria and pull it out, and it's not going to do anything because my skin's a great barrier. But when you have the dog scratching, you make the skin inflamed, then you've opened yourself up, or the dog's opened itself up, for getting secondary infections. And these infections are typically either like a staph infection or a yeast infection. And when we have a dog that gets recurrent infections, or one that isn't responding to therapy, we start looking at getting appropriate cultures done so that we can pick the right antibiotic. Just like in the human world, we're seeing more and more dogs developing methicillin-resistant staph infections. Fortunately, it's not quite as problematic for people. It's called staph intermedius. And so instead of MRSA, we see MRSA-I most of the time. We still can see the human staph aureus resistant bug as well in dogs, but that tends to be very uncommon. So treat the secondary infections. Number two, bathe your dog more frequently. And by that, I mean at least 1 to 2 times a week, preferably twice a week, in a good medicated shampoo. Not only will that cut down on the bacterial agents on your dog's skin, but it'll also help remove some of those allergens that they're having contact with. When you have your dog coming in and out from being outside, it's important to also wipe them down. And I call it damp mopping them. Any place that has thin skin and, you know, the hairless kind of areas, so the inside of the ears, the feet, the belly. And one of the wipes that I like to use, which is an antibacterial wipe, you can get through dairy supply places. They're teat wipes that dairymen use, and they're called Nissen wipes. I think the brand name is called Wipeout, and you can get them in a big bucket, very inexpensively online. And that's something that you get into the habit of, you know, every time they come in, you're going to damp mop your dog to get rid of some of those allergens. That may be helpful. Your idea about diet is a good one, although food allergies, actually being allergic and having the food be the cause of your dog's itching, is rather uncommon. It only counts for about 10% of the allergy type cases that we see in the veterinary world. But what you can do with food is make sure that your dog is on a skin-sensitive diet, usually one that is very high in essential fatty acids, EPA and DHA and so on, in the right balance. They take several months of being on those fatty acid supplements to be able to take effect. So if you have a dog that this is seasonal, you got to start looking at, okay, it's March, it's not even allergy season yet, but we're going to get this dog going on a fatty acid supplement. And there are diets out there that will meet that need as well. And you could check with your veterinarian. Some of them are therapeutic diets, and there are some that are over-the-counter diets that are going to meet that need too. Make sure you're practicing good flea control and be religious about it. We're in the heat of flea season right now, and I'm seeing two or three cases a day coming in with fleas if they're not on good flea control, and I think it's just because of the weather we've been having. All it takes is one flea bite to be triggering your dog to continue to have this problem. This is going to be a lifetime problem for you, and people that have dogs with allergies have their basket of medication, and it's a daily surveillance what needs to be treated today. And I'm sorry, but that's the case. Yeah. And then you're looking at, visiting maybe with a dermatologist for allergy testing, desensitization, either shots or sublingual drops, other drugs rather than steroids. Long-term steroid use is going to damage the skin, but you can use things like cyclosporine, which is going to be safer. A little more expensive, but that would be something else to make your dog feel more comfortable as well. So lots of different steps. And one last thing, change your dog's bedding frequently. Wash it frequently. That's a great place for allergens to build up as well.
There you go. Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, Professor of Veterinary Medicine at the UW-Madison School of Vet Medicine, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller, Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Questions? Call us at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. And you can post questions or a photo as well. It's always cool. We love the pet photos that we get when Sandy's on. Go to the Larry Mueller Show. That's my Facebook page name. And you can post right there, question and or photo. We had an email from Jason in Eau Claire, Sandy, who has a nine-month-old Siberian Husky. Read different options on when to switch to adult dog food. Most of the information depends on breed and size. His dog around 40 pounds, very slender, still about full-grown according to AKC guidelines. She's allowed to freely eat because she does not have much of an appetite or an overeating problem. Should I keep her on puppy food or the added calories for the added calories, or would adult food be more appropriate?
Yeah, good question. We used to tell people at the time of spay or neuter, get them off of the puppy formula and onto an adult formula. But nutritionists are saying we probably should keep them on it until they're full grown. And again, that's going to be very breed related. Little dogs are going to mature a little bit faster. Of course, the giant breed dogs are still growing out to a year and a half, sometimes maturing out until 2 years of age. And so what's different between adult food and puppy food, besides the fact that puppy food's a little bit higher in calories, is there's often a difference in the mineral content to help support bone growth and bone development. And I don't look at as a nine-year-old Sheltie, or Husky, I should say, as being fully mature.
Nine-month-old,
being fully mature at this point. So I would be saying probably, continue the puppy formula out till at least a year, maybe 14 months of age, and then consider switching over to an adult formula once that skeleton is fully formed. I think it would be very helpful, especially if this dog's going to be used for any pulling or running or anything where we really need to have those good strong joints and bones.
Heidi in Oak Creek, thank you for waiting. Hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My question is about the DHLPP vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
I have two dogs who are 14 and 13 years old, and they've received that vaccine their whole lives. Every year. And recently I've done some research online that said that you could make that interval between that vaccine up to 3 years.
Oh,
and I would like
yeah.
your opinion about how you feel about that.
I am so glad that you're doing some homework, and I strongly recommend everyone that has a pet always know, kind of do that homework before you go to your veterinarian so that you are armed with, hey, this is what is being published. Why are we doing it this way? And your veterinarian may have their own reason, because maybe you're in an area with a lot of parvo or a lot of distemper. But generally, the guidelines are, and this is where we have the problem. You have mentioned a combination vaccine, and what you've said is distemper. H stands for hepatitis, and I am truly hopeful that your veterinarian is not still using hepatitis vaccine. Hepatitis vaccine is in a class of viruses called adenovirus 1. And that particular hepatitis can cause a pretty serious eye problem in dogs called blue eye. It's an inflammation in the eye. And we've known about that for years and years. And although there are still vaccines out there that contain hepatitis, you would want to make sure you're using one that says adenovirus 2. That doesn't cause blue eye and it cross protects for hepatitis. And I think sometimes it's just we in the medical profession get a little lazy. It's easier to write an H down than it is an A with a, you know, subscript of 2. But so we've got those two things going on. And then the other, the PP, stands for parvovirus and parainfluenza. Those being all viruses, yes, the national guidelines in the canine vaccine guidelines that are published by the American Animal Hospital Association says that dogs should be vaccinated with a series as a puppy a year later and then every 3 years after that. And they may even have longer immunity from those 3 years as well. And I have some owners that opt to do titers, which is looking at their immune response to measure, do we really need to be boostering or not? The other letter that I have not brought up yet is that one right in the middle of what you said, the DHLPP, and that L stands for leptospirosis. Lepto is a bacterium, and it's a bacterial-caused disease. And unfortunately for that component, it does not provide good long-term immunity. And that particular ingredient needs to be used on an annual basis to give your dog protection. And so that is one that needs to still be given. So what do we do at the vet school? We have a separate distemper, adeno 2, parainfluenza, parvo vaccine that we give. And then if we have a dog that needs lepto, we have a separate lepto vaccine. So some years, every year they're getting lepto, and then every 3 years they're getting the DAP vaccine. And the other reason why we've done that is there's very good evidence that when we make a vaccine that is actually mixed viruses and bacteria together, all in one. And again, these vaccines are still very readily available where the lepto is mixed with the viral components and you're kind of giving the dog a big shotgun all at once. That by combining those two things and giving it in one site in a dog's body, it drives the allergic reaction. And so the push is to not make those vaccines anymore, to make it a little harder for veterinarians and pets because they have to get two shots. But even giving both the lepto and the DAP vaccine on the same visit, but in different sites in the dog's body, significantly can cut down on that allergic reaction. So that is the trends. That's what's being recommended. And I would be talking to your veterinarian about that and say, yep, I want my dog to get the lepto component, but I don't want anything else. And they should be able to hopefully do that for you.
Mm-hmm. I did also read that leptospirosis infections in Wisconsin are not common.
Oh, I beg to differ.
Okay.
I beg to differ. And it may be the location that you're in, but leptospirosis is actually, we're seeing it on the rise. It's spread through the urine of infected animals, and it likes to survive in damp areas. And so anytime you've got a dog that is swimming, exposed to farm animals, living here, even in the city of Madison, we've got urbanized raccoons that are coming up on our deck at night. One of my last lepto fatalities was a very small dog that never left their yard, but they had a raccoon coming on their deck at night, raiding their bird feeders and using their deck as a latrine. And the dog came in contact with it. That's what we're assuming, and ended up dying of leptospirosis. It is a treatable disease if you, one, diagnose it, but they're usually in critical care and it causes liver and kidney failure. So if your dog is at risk, which almost every dog really is, unless you're living in an apartment building and your dog rarely ever touches the ground, probably should be vaccinated for leptospirosis.
There you go, Heidi. Thanks a lot for calling. And that's good information for lots of people, I am sure. Ron in Newburgh, it's your turn. Hi, Ron.
Good morning, and thank you, Larry and Sandy. The question is, what to do with a cat who stopped drinking water? He's 8 years old and weighs 14 pounds. Last August, that's 2012, we had a minor problem with this, but once I bought a cat water fountain took care of it. This June 7th, he pretty much stopped drinking water despite having three water bowls and one drinking fountain. We've carefully monitored his urine to keep it below 1.06 or 1.062.
Okay.
I can't by myself inject water under the skin. So therefore, we've been using a plastic syringe to squirt it in his mouth, 130 milliliters, which is about a half a cup or a little bit more of water per day. The vet, we've had a full set of lab tests done, showed nothing. The vet has no explanation and is concerned when a specific gravity goes over 106 or 106.2.
Oh, yeah. I don't know either. That's very, very strange. Sometimes, I mean, cats are unique in that because of their ancestry, they have developed kidneys that are really able to recycle all lots and lots of water. And so their urine is typically very concentrated compared to other species. And sometimes if we are feeding canned food, that often provides enough moisture to be able to meet the cat's needs, and you rarely ever see them drinking. I've had some cats that will get their moisture from just licking the floor of the shower after people have had a shower, or you catch the, you know, drinking out of the toilet or a dripping faucet. So I'm wondering if your cat's getting something somewhere else, or, you know, do you have your cat on a canned food diet?
He does not like the canned cat food. Breakfast and lunch, he gets crunchers. And at supper time, he'll eat maybe a third of a small can of the canned cat food, or even less than that, half of a third. I've tried putting water in with the canned cat food. Then he definitely won't touch it.
Okay. I don't have any other suggestions for you, but I mean, I'm glad you're monitoring to make sure that his hydration status is staying normal. You know, unless he's got some type of a weird neurologic problem, or there was something that happened in the water bowl that scared him. Things that I'll tell people to do if they've got a cat that is reluctant to use a water bowl is do things like the fountain like you're using. Sometimes we'll go with, putting even like big marbles or something in the bottom of the dish so the cat has something that they can focus on. Since their depth perception isn't great, many cats will get like a snootful and they, you know, have to avoid, going up to the water dish. That's why I think a lot of cats will bat at the water. They'll put their foot in it and kind of make ripples, and then they drink. Is there any way your cat's like just licking moisture off of their feet from somewhere? I mean, that would be another thing I'd be worried, not thinking about. But if he's happy and he's healthy and he's staying well hydrated, something's going on, because he sure isn't getting enough water from what you're describing.
Are you on a municipal water?
No. I'm on well, and he will lick the water off the grass in the morning.
Okay,
If his specific gravity went up to 1.075 when we found this problem, and then the vet couldn't even get any urine out of him to try to analyze what it was.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, so he may be getting some source outside that he likes. I would, consider maybe trying something like bottled water, maybe. Yeah, I'm wondering if he would like things like clam juice, which you can buy. It's kind of ugly looking gray stuff that you can get at the grocery store. But if he likes that, you may want to give that a try. There's even things like it's a soya-based cat milk called Catsip that, again, may provide some moisture and calories. You have to be careful with that. But I'd be looking at, just trying different things that rather than just water, because your, syringing it into his mouth may be enough for him to develop an aversion to water, because it's like every time I go near anything like this, somebody grabs me and shoves water in my mouth. So I don't want to go near water. Mm-hmm. So that may be adding to the problem. So, try some of those other things and see if that doesn't work, and let us know next month.
Yeah. Thanks, Ron, for calling. Appreciate it. And Scott in West Allis. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, guys. I have a little problem here. I have a 70-year-old domestic long-haired kitty cat. And the cat basically was a transplant from my ex-wife that she basically gave it up and gave it back to me, and it's over at my girlfriend's house. Long story short, she has another cat there. Cat's eating very well. It was a little small for weight-wise. He's gaining weight, socializing very well, getting along with everybody. He has an issue with some hair clumping pulling out, and he also has an issue with defecating next to the litter box, not in the litter box. Litter's been being changed regularly. He's keeping it clean, and we're still having issues with it. I'm wondering if you have any ideas.
Yeah. How many litter boxes are in the house?
There are two litter boxes in the house. There needs to be another one. I agree with that. But she has a two-bedroom apartment, so it's kind of hard to put another one in somewhere. We've got to try to find a place.
And are they side by side?
No, they're not. They're in different places.
Different locations.
Weight competition.
Are they covered or open pans?
Open.
Open pans. And, you know, you want to have a litter box at least 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to butt. So it needs to be a fairly, you know, good size box.
Not overly large for a kitty cat. It's probably, I'm guessing, maybe 7-8 pounds on a good day.
Okay, okay.
Not a really large cat.
Yeah. You know, it's funny you mentioned he's a long-haired cat, and when you start looking at incidents of litter box issues, long-haired cats and Persians in particular are very much overrepresented, and we don't know whether it's the fact that they're getting the dust from the litter on their hindy, or, you know, they just don't like cuddling up with the litter when it's that deep. But a couple of things that I would be recommending that you try. Number one would be making sure that there isn't a medical reason going on. I just had a cat in the other day that had been pooping out of the box for several months. And I just said, well, let's check the anal glands, and expressed the anal glands. And the owner wrote me back a week later and said, thank you so much. Everything's cured. The cat is now back using the litter box again. So sometimes it can be something as simple as that that could trigger it.
Yep.
Yeah. And I've had other, you know, owners will do things like get one of those boot trays that have, you know, very low edge entry rather than a standard litter box. And
the boxes aren't really very tall. No, I don't think it's really that issue. I don't know. I think considering, because it's a newer place, it might be a stress-related thing.
It's possible. Most cats
transplant.
Yeah, most cats urinate out of the box rather than defecate. And the fact that he's going next to the box tells me that, boy, you know, there's just something about that box that he doesn't want to use. And that's why experimenting with either the height of the litter box, the type of the litter that you're using, and, you know, maybe try putting, like, right next to the box a very low-profile tray with something like a wheat-based litter or, you know, a corn-based litter or something that's a little bit different than what you're currently using, and see if he will use that instead. Mm-hmm. But always get them in for a medical evaluation to make sure that there isn't something physically going on that could be triggering this as well.
Yep, absolutely. Scott, good luck. Thank you for calling. Sue in Sugar Camp, hello.
Hi. First of all, just a report on some advice I got from you last spring. I had called in about my 14-year-old Springer, who was doing quite a bit of pacing, and you suggested to try him on Nutrex.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to be working. And at any rate, he's holding his own.
Wonderful. Wonderful.
And so, of course, I'm afraid to take him off of it because I don't want any regression. So we're going to keep that going. But
okay.
I have another question. And it has to do with some possible spinal deterioration problems leading to some weakness in his back leg.
Mm-hmm.
He still gets along pretty well. Swimming seems to be really helpful for him. He loves to swim. I mean, we don't overdo it, but if he can go out and swim, it just seems like he feels so much better. I mean, he's got some pep in his step then. And I'm just wondering about, you know, a long-term thing as far as treatments or something like that. Is there anything that is effective, or do we just kind of ride this out and make him comfortable and help him along here? And he's on meloxicam.
Okay. So meloxicam is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory pain medication that's going to take down inflammation. And so that's helpful for dogs that have arthritis or, you know, arthritis-related pain. And that's the dilemma, is I don't know whether his weakness is due to osteoarthritis and it's just making him not want to move around. He's lost some of his muscle mass because of that, and that's making him weaker because his joints hurt, or whether he truly has a neurologic problem like a spinal cord issue where we've got either a spinal cord degeneration or something like a slipped disc or something that is not allowing those nerve impulses to get back to the legs, and that's what's making him weak. And so typically if I have a dog come in to see me that has this type of history, I'll go through a thorough physical and a neurologic exam and see if I can figure out if there is actually nerve weakness. If that's the case, you're going looking at a whole different workup that's involved, usually getting spinal x-rays done, other imaging done like an MRI or a myelogram to be able to see if they can localize where the problem is and if this is something that could be surgically corrected. So that would be the kind of the path you would go down that way. But your idea of doing water aerobics, regardless of what the cause is wonderful. It's giving him some buoyancy. It's allowing him to help maintain what muscle strength he has, which is really important. And if you're finding that that helps doing it just on your own, you'd probably find that working with a physical therapist that's comfortable that's with working with animals would probably benefit him even more. Using things like an underwater treadmill where he would have that buoyancy, but still some movement to help get those joints and things limbered up a little bit. Some exercises that you could potentially do at home that would help maintain his muscle strength as well without overdoing it. So I think number one, you need to get a diagnosis as to, is this neurologic? Is this orthopedic? And then take it from there, depending on what you've got. But a physical therapist would probably be one of the things you want to add to what you're doing right now.
Yep. And thanks a lot for calling. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, professor of veterinary medicine at the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Medicine. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine as our guest today, talking about your pet's health. Call in at 800-642-1234. Post a photo or question on my Facebook page. That page is The Larry Mueller Show. And matter of fact, Rob sent a photo of Slim, who's going out for a drive, and
oh, what a beautiful pity. You know, he's got a necktie on, it looks like. Yeah. He's all dressed for the road. Yeah.
It's very, very cool. We had a Facebook question from Pat, who wonders advice for a cat's, a male and a female, with feline lower urinary tract disease. Been to the vet, no urinary stones, urethral plugs, just recurring irritation infections.
Okay. When we see cats that have blood in their urine, especially a younger cat under 10 years of age, there's kind of a top number of things that we think about, and then that's a few oddball things. But the thing that many people think of, they see blood and they think, oh, there's got to be an infection there. Actually, cats under 10, less than 2% of cats with a blood in their urine actually have a urinary tract infection.
Hmm.
Older cats, because they have something that usually compromises their ability to concentrate their urine, like kidney failure, diabetes, are more prone to getting urinary tract infections. And so we get a little more concerned about that. Your veterinarian sounds like they've ruled out stones and problems by taking x-rays, an ultrasound of the bladder. And if there's nothing like that there, then it kind of, we just chalk this up to something called feline interstitial cystitis, or sometimes we'll call it, people just call it fluted, feline lower urinary tract disease. I think that's kind of too encompassing. Sterile cystitis would be the other thing that we see. And the way I like to look at the cat's bladder is it's kind of like our stomach. When we get upset, we get an upset tummy. When cats get stressed and upset, they get an inflamed bladder wall. And a few things that you can do. One, decrease stressors. If these two cats don't get along, or you've got stray cats hanging around outside, you know, give the cats a break, either adding in more cat trees, plugging in a feel-away diffuser. Anything that you can do to make their life less stressful. We'll sometimes also be looking at what we can do dietarily to help these cats. And one of the things that's been found to be very helpful and reduced by, I think it's over 30% of the recurrence rate, is just taking whatever you're feeding them now and switch it over to a canned food diet. It doesn't even have to be anything special. It can be their regular food. Switching to a canned food diet will help prevent some of those reoccurrences. Water, 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 water. water fountains, bowls, just like that last caller had wanted, you know, was having for his cat. You want to make sure that they're drinking, because that helps stretch that bladder wall a little bit if they're taking in more water, and it helps release some of those inflammatory mediators, and they feel a whole lot better. So more water if you can. The Hills Company has a diet out called CD Multi, and that has now just got the label for controlling this problem as well. And I can't remember what the exact percentage is, but it's pretty high. And so it's available in a dry in a can, but it's the way it's formulated, and this would be a therapeutic diet that you would have to get through your veterinarian. That may be another way of preventing this. If we have recurrences over and over and over and over and over again, some of these cats have to go on psychoactive drugs such as amitriptyline, but it's a huge commitment. It's not something you just use, start and stop. They have to be on it every day, twice a day, for months on end. And it has its own side effect profile. It's not labeled for cat use. And I've never used it in any of these cats, because usually this is just a temporary thing we can manage doing these other things I mentioned.
There we go. Armando in Galena, Illinois, thanks for calling. Hi.
Good afternoon, or good morning, Larry and Dr. Sasha. Thank you very much for your program.
Sure.
It's very informative. My question is about the wrapping of a leg of a dog that was injured by a gunshot wound. What happened was that my dog was shot in the front leg, and, of course, I was very worried, and I took it to a veterinarian. And it was after hours, and they told me that the amputation was going to be $1,500, and I couldn't afford it. So they told me whether it's going to be amputation or euthanasia. And I said, I don't want that. Anyhow, I requested my dog, and eventually they gave me my dog, but after they prepared the dog. And I didn't understand what the preparing of the dog was. And when they gave me my dog, her leg was totally wrapped. Like it looked like a baseball bat with basically no air coming in and out of the shoulder or the leg, and it with a rubberized material that was blue. Anyhow, that night my dog was crying very loudly, and the wrapping seems too strong, too tight. So I tried to open, and it was very hard with the scissors because it was very difficult to cut.
Mm-hmm.
And anyhow, at least I was able to open or unwrap a little bit in the shoulder, so there is some circulation there. The next day, I took it to another veterinarian who did the amputation for half the cost. And when I pick up the, and I say, save the leg to show the police.
Mm-hmm.
Anyhow, when I pick up the dog, I say, so how was it? And he says, well, the leg was already smelling bad, and I was a little worried about the discoloration in the muscle. To make a long story short, the dog is recuperating quite well with the three legs.
Mm-hmm.
But when I unwrapped the leg, I had to cut through lots of layers of gauze, and then the first layer was the ram wrapped directly over the wound. And that was so unusual. I have talked to many people, and I say, I don't understand that. And that leg was already stinking quite bad.
Yeah.
Is that a proper way to wrap a leg?
Well, it may be that they were using a medical type of material called Tegaderm, which looks like Saran wrap. And it is actually a breathable, but a barrier that will cover it up. And I know it looks just like Saran wrap. It really does. And so that may be what they did. It sounds like what they put, the type of bandage that they put on your dog is called a Robert Jones bandage, which is to help immobilize the leg, where there's like lots and lots and lots of padding and gauze around it. So they use a lot of cotton and gauze. And then they put a vet wrap over top of it to protect it. And what they were attempting to do is probably just stabilize the leg. And, you know, I'm not sure how bad the gunshot wound was, but if the blood supply to the leg was compromised, that may be why there was odor there and so on, is because the leg was dead and was not salvageable, which is why they were recommending amputation. So I would have I'd be hard pressed to say any veterinarian would put Saran wrap on an open wound, But I know many, many, many veterinarians that use this Tegaderm stuff that comes in big sheets. So it doesn't look like a little Band-Aid. It's huge sheets of it that can cover up these wounds. And that's probably what they put on there just to help control some of the bleeding and the leaking. So I'm glad your dog is doing well. And so many dogs with three legs, they don't go through the emotional issues that people do with amputation. They know that the pain's gone and they just get up and move and get around without any trouble at all. So I'm glad everything's in the end worked up. But it's kind of, I'm a little kind of like squeamish here. I would not have wanted to have my dog's leg back afterwards. But that's to each his own, I guess.
Thank you very much for calling, Armando, and I'm glad your dog is better. And I guess he wanted the leg to give to the police.
Oh, but, yeah, because he probably had to do something like that just in case it was going to become a legal battle. Yeah.
Thanks again, Armando. Catherine and Merrill, hi, thank you for calling.
Wonderful program. I just enjoy it so much when Dr. Sasha is on. There's a lot of information that she provides, and I thank you for this.
Oh, you're welcome.
And I have a question about a friend's senior, a large, but maybe about a 95-pound husky.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when it's there are storms, the dog gets crazy and paces and whatever. But even sometimes when there aren't storms, the dog will pace and wake people up, and the members in the house can't sleep. And is there anything that this dog can be given, like, say, Benadryl or Valium or something that would work to calm this dog down? And I know there are wraps that you can put around him, but he's a big dog and he's a senior dog.
Yeah. Always make sure that there isn't something medical going on. Make sure that the dog's vision is normal, their hearing is normal, their blood pressure is normal, that they don't have, you know, some other underlying problem that could be making him, you know, be in this anxious state. And there are, you know, some weird tumors, pheochromocytoma, if that's a long name for one, but, you know, there's that happens to be one that can secrete adrenaline and just their heart starts racing and yet there's a medical cause for it. If we've got a senior dog that is, and I live with one as well, Bulldozer is now like 10 and a half, and he is up and down at night a lot, pacing, panting. A few things that you may want to try. One is leaving a nightlight on so that they can orient to it. You may want to consider still that thunder shirt or the anxiety wrap. And before you go out and even invest in one, I tell people to go online and just look at pictures. There's this whole anxiety wrap started back years ago. There's a woman named Linda Tellington Jones, and she developed a whole system called the T-Touch system, which is a way of like pressure therapy for making dogs feel calmer and more comfortable. And she demonstrates how to use a ACE bandage wrap around the dog's body in a number of ways. And again, it's just easier to put on one of these thunder shirts than it is to do this ACE bandage business. But that may give you an idea as to whether it's going to work or not before you start making an investment in an extra large anxiety wrap. There are drugs that may help with cognitive decline. We already had somebody call that said their dog's doing better on a drug named Nutrix. It's a drug that I have my dog on that is a jellyfish extract that helps with some of the cognitive decline issues. I've had some success with giving my dog at night a little trazodone, which is a human medication that is used as a sleep aid as well as an anti-anxiety medication. And that would be something their veterinarian could be looking into. Valium and Xanax, it may knock their socks off. I mean, this would be these, again, human drugs. Some dogs actually have a paradoxical effect and get more anxious when they're on that. So you always want to do a dry run. And some of them just don't like the feel. They panic more when they're not able to get up and move around as well as they should. So that would be something to consider trying. I've had some dogs that we've had great success with using melatonin in, which is an over-the-counter product that is used for people with jet lag and to help with sleeping as well. But the thing that I've had the least success with is what you mentioned, Benadryl, because most dogs will just override it. So I would avoid that. But melatonin over-the-counter, trying the T-Touch wrap, and then getting into some of these other medications that would be prescription drugs from your veterinarian.
Mm-hmm. There we go.
Thanks very much. Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Catherine, for calling. And how about the debate on corn-free versus grain-free on the diet side? Brianna wants to know the best recommendation for a growing large breed.
Yeah, you got an hour.
Yeah, and actually we only have about 40 seconds.
Okay. Corn is actually, if it's prepared correctly, very digestible and provides the dog with lots of great nutrients. And I do not look at corn as being a bad ingredient. It is probably one of the things that we see the least amount of food allergies to. And if it's prepared appropriately, with the balanced diet, it can be part of a balanced diet. And I think that, you know, people have got on this grain-free, no corn diet and so on. And it is really just a fad that's out there. It makes sense for cats, but it doesn't make sense for dogs.
All right. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest today. She is a professor of veterinary medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and she comes by once a month, usually on the second Tuesday of the month. So I know her next appearance is going to be Tuesday, October 8th, which would be the second Tuesday of October. But she's with us today right up until 12:30. You can call in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. Go to my Facebook page, post a pet photo or a question there. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. We'll be back with Dr. Sandy right after this look at the news. Stay with us. Well, just like with human health concerns, it can be stressful when a pet is ill, not only for the pet, but for you too. And with so much information out there, sometimes, we have one item contradicting another, as a matter of fact. It's hard to know where to turn. Well, Larry Mueller here, and once a month we have Dr. Sandy Sawchuk with us from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. We know we can turn to her. And here she is again. Great to have you with us today, Sandy.
You know, I'm glad to be here, but you should always talk to your veterinarian as well, because I'm giving my opinion and, no. You know, again, it's a lot of times it's just opinion, but, I don't want to make anybody out there, especially my colleagues, go, wow, you know, they have to trust her and they can't trust me, you know. But,
no.
I have something, I've been playing it on my iPad, and it's the AVMA, American Veterinary Medical Association, just put out a new game on that you can get for your smartphone or your iPad or whatever, and it is just called AVMA Animal Hospital. And you get various species in, dogs, cats, turtles, birds, and so on. And they're sick and they give you their symptoms and you have to decide what tests you want to do and then how you want to treat it. And,
oh, cool.
And it's designed for younger, 10 to 15 year old people that want to make kids that might go, hey, maybe I want to be a veterinarian. But even as a vet, I'm having fun playing with it. And actually on a couple of the animals clicked the wrong thing as to what I wanted to do. And I'm like, oh, damn.
So, man.
So I don't even have a perfect score. Yeah.
Well, we have, that app, I've got to get that app. And it's free?
It's free, yeah.
We have some recent posts, photos. Gail sent a photo of Buffy, going to be 12, and jumps on the couch and back on the porch after squirrels and seems to get some sore legs once in a while from doing that.
Well, 12 years old, those joints have, with all that jumping. But the dog looks like it's in pretty good shape, if that's not body fat, but hair. So, yeah.
Maybe a little arthritis coming there.
Yeah.
And Armando, who we were talking about earlier, whose dog was shot, sent us a picture of his dog with wrapped up. The leg wrapped up.
And you know what? That looks exactly like the kind of wrap our surgeons or I would be putting on something, especially if it was for transport just to support it. And that looks like what we call a Robert Jones bandage, which is one of these ones that allows the leg to be able to swell if it needs to. But, you know, it does stabilize it. So that looks like a pretty professional bandage. And when you've got an open wound under like that, you know, you're trying to keep bugs out of it rather than let air get to it. So I would have to agree with the emergency clinic that they did a good job in putting that bandage on.
Well, Gene in Elk Mound has a question. Gene, let's go to you now. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Sorry, I'm inside a building, so I might lose you. Hopefully not. I had a miniature schnauzer. She's 12 years old. She's very healthy, minus having a fatty tumor on her chest.
Mm-hmm.
We've had it removed twice. And it had made her, I can't believe the fatty tumor, how toxic it made her system. And she couldn't eat, she'd throw up.
And that is, I'm very surprised as well, because lipomas are benign and they're more mechanically can sometimes be a problem. They're a cosmetic issue for the majority of dogs. Did you actually have it biopsied, actually have a lab look at the tissue to make sure that it was not a liposarcoma, like a malignant type of fatty tumor?
Nope. It was, no.
Okay.
Yes, it was sent out and tested.
Okay.
So, but they couldn't get it all because it was too close to her heart. So it obviously kept coming back.
Okay.
But she was just like a little puppy. She was 12 years old at the last surgery, and she came home, and she was like a two-year-old pup.
Okay.
You know, a miniature schnauzer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's like having a two-year-old all the time.
Uh-huh.
We came home from the trip, and she was being watched, taken care of. And we were out in the garden, and she, since she was a baby, would go to outside and pick her own cherry tomatoes.
Okay.
I was like, fine, whatever. Just don't eat the green ones.
So what can we do to help you?
Well, she died almost 3 weeks ago.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm not sure exactly what happened. She was in the garden. She was picking her tomatoes while I was picking other things. She was rooting in my bucket, eating some broccoli.
Mm-hmm.
And then she went over and drank out of the bird bath I have in the garden,
mm-hmm.
which is full of bird poop. Next day, she's, like, sick, vomiting, diarrhea. So I take her in, and they said, you know, it was like there was a lot of things crawling around in the stool, and they rehydrated her. She got really dehydrated.
Okay.
I couldn't get her to drink, or I couldn't keep anything down, and they gave her some... like Pepto-Bismol with neomycin in it. And then she wouldn't touch food. She would not eat.
I had to drive her.
I knew she was sick when she didn't want, like, a pizza bite.
Yeah, and, you know, and sometimes bird baths and bird seed areas, that's one area where you want to probably try to keep your pet away. A lot of birds can carry salmonella, which is a bacteria that... for the majority of dogs, they can tolerate it pretty well, but it can make dogs and people very ill at times. And I'm wondering if that's what was going on with her. But, you know, I'm a little confused about lipomas near her heart. We hardly ever see, I mean, you can periodically see intrathoracic lipomas where they're inside the chest wall. But most of them are going to be outside the body, between the skin and the body wall. And so I'm a little confused about that. But I think anytime we have confusion regarding a death of a pet, I strongly recommend having an autopsy done. And although it may be hard to be thinking about your animal being opened up and looked at, pathologists are, you know, treat every patient with respect. Many of them you can get their remains back so that you can have them buried, or, you know, you have them cremated so you can still get her remains back. But The reason why I recommend having an autopsy done is it helps give closure. That is probably the biggest thing. It answers all those unanswered questions, may open a few more, but it makes you realize that it maybe it wasn't something that I did. It wasn't the fact that I let her go near the bird bath or that I was missing out on some type of symptoms that I could have been treated earlier. So I don't know if that was done, but, you know, in the future, you know, anytime you have a pet that has these unanswered questions, it really, really does help. And again, I'm so sorry for your loss.
Very sorry. Jean.
Thank you. And the other thing was we did bury her right away because she died at like midnight. And we got a letter from the doctor. From the vet saying, we're sorry, you know, pancreatitis is, you know, very catchy or whatever. And I'm just thinking she thought of my other dog that we had. Mm-hmm. I love miniature schnauzers, by the way.
Yeah. And pancreatitis is something that can be, it's an inflammation of the pancreas. It can come on very quickly. It's often associated with eating things like getting into garbage, a high fat meal, and, you know, any dog can get it. It's, you know, and it can be something that can be managed, but you're often looking at critical care management. And even with that, some dogs just don't make it. And we had one patient recently that ended up for several weeks just while the pancreas was healing, ended up having to have a stomach tube in and so on, and has now bounced back and is her old normal self again. But it can be quite complicated, and that's why I'm glad I work where I do, because we've got a critical care and criticalist there around the clock to be able to help with these patients.
Yeah, absolutely. Jean, thank you very much for calling again. Very sorry for your loss, but I appreciate your call and your comments. Braxton in Eau Claire, we'll turn to you next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi there. I've got kind of a debate I want you to settle for me.
Okay.
My girlfriend has two cats, and they had cat acne. We took care of it. We got the medicine, cleaned them up, got rid of all of our plastic bowls. But I have a Great Dane, and she uses a Big Dog Drinkwell water fountain, which is plastic.
Mm-hmm.
We stopped using it for a while, and I want to use it again because her drool can pretty much turn any water bowl into jello in about a day.
Okay.
And this Drinkwell, I mean, it runs through a charcoal and a material filter, and it keeps it so I can have a bowl for about a week instead.
Yeah.
Is it okay to keep using that, even though it's plastic, or should we just stay away from it?
Well, I'm not sure if the cats want to drink out of, dog slobbered up water, but I would be providing them with other sources of water as well. We still don't know whether plastic is one of those causes of cats getting acne. One of the thoughts is that because we tend to not wash our cat food bowls, if you're using a plastic food dish and you're putting food in it, you've got rancid oils and things, and that may be causing some irritation to the skin and resulting in them breaking out in acne. Dishes such as stainless and so on and ceramic aren't going to hold those oils as well, and so they wash up a little bit easier. So, I'm not convinced that plastic is the key for dealing with this. It's just one of those things that we say, yeah, wash the food bowls more often and maybe consider switching to ceramic or metal. It may help. I think, you know, if a water bowl, they're probably not going to be getting their chin right up to the plastic. They'll probably be, you know, either looking at the water that's running and drinking from there or more in the center of the dish. Just because it's all water, they're not trying to get that last crumb of food out of the corner of the bowl. So I don't think it would be a problem at all. But if you really want to make your girlfriend happy, they do make stainless steel dog water fountains now.
Yeah.
And ceramic. And so you can spend a little more money and everybody will be happy. You'll be happy. The dog will be happy and your girlfriend will be happy.
There you go. Thanks, Braxton, for calling. Appreciate it. Everybody's happy. Let's go to Candace and Nina. Hi, Candace.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's on your mind?
Can you hear me? Okay. I just wanted to
tell you what a great experience my sister had at the vet school.
Oh, I'd love to hear what happened. Yes.
Actually, her little dog was extremely sick. She's got a Cavalier King Charles Spaniel. She took it to the vet. It had like 4 pounds of fluid in its abdomen.
Ooh.
And they were running tests. And then she called me and I said, well, you know, I know I hear about the vet school, you know, because I listen to this show.
Mm-hmm.
And she called, and they got her in the next day, and they called her that evening. 2 different doctors called her at home. They went, and they spent from 10 in the morning till 8 at night at the school. They figured out what the problem was. She had some kind of a genetic disorder. Today, I talked to my sister today. The dog is completely back to normal. They called her every day afterwards to make sure, because she had to administer some shots and different medications.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And her vet was just thrilled that she went, and because she would have had to have waited several days for the test results to come back from him.
Yeah.
So it was just a great, great experience. So,
well, wonderful. Wow. And that's something that, you know, as a business, we have in the past had, you know, issues with communication. We are doing everything in our power to be like the best communicators around. I went to a communication kind of crash course. Many of the doctors in the hospital have. We have a veterinary communications course for the students. We record make sure that we make, you know, notations on every phone call that we make. We try to fax the veterinarian right away, contact the veterinarian by phone right away. I spend probably half my life at the vet school either writing or on the phone. But you know what? That's what you need to do. That's how you're going to be able to, you know, get on top of things earlier, make people feel more comfortable with having their pet out of their care and in somebody else's care. And I'm so happy that the experience was great for you. You know, it's sometimes, you know, we get our hackles up, you know, with the odd, you know, complaint that happens. But for the most part, this is all I hear, which is why I'm so happy to be one of the many faculty members at the vet school. So thank you for that information.
And then there was one more thing. When she was really concerned about the cost, and so she talked ahead of them and said, this is the amount of money that I can afford to spend. And so she said throughout the day, you know, they looked at different tests and said, you know, we'll do this and this and this and not that one, whatever. And in the end, they stayed within the, you know, her parameters that she had to stay within cost-wise. And so it was just, it
very
was great.
Good.
So,
good. Good. Yeah. And there's always options. And that's, you know, we have to present everything. And, you know, sometimes we can't do everything we want. But, you know, in many cases, we are able to adjust our therapeutic plans and diagnostic plans to be able to meet the owner's needs.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Candace. Mm-hmm. Appreciate your call very much. Wayne in West Allis has a question for you, Sandy. Hi, Wayne.
Hello, Larry. Hi, hello, Dr. Sajcek.
Hello.
I'm a little concerned about my dog's strange diet behavior, somewhat like the lady before you whose dog got sick on tomatoes. I have an overabundance of these cherry tomatoes, and every day I'm out there picking them and eating them off the vine, and my dog started begging for them, and I started giving them to her. I'd pick them first, and so they were clean, and she'd eat up and eat them and beg for more. And she also will eat bananas, and she will also eat nectarines.
Well, it sounds like she's quite the gourmet dog. Yeah.
I'm just wondering if they're, you know, that's not an animal diet, I don't think.
Well, dogs aren't strict carnivores. They are omnivorous, and so it's okay to add some fruits and vegetables as long as, again, 90% of their diet is a well-balanced diet. I'm a table scrap hand router, just like almost everybody else. I hate to admit it, but you make sure that they get the balanced diet first before they get anything else. When it comes to the things that you mentioned, none of those make me feel like, we're going to be in trouble. if she gets an upset tummy from them, if she starts getting diarrhea, obviously she's taking in too many and you may have to stop. The things that you would want to avoid, though, would be grapes and raisins, okay? So those are toxic for dogs. It's very unique to dogs, but it can put them into kidney failure. So, and the amount that a dog has to eat is quite variable, but, you know, I would just say avoid it. Totally. No grapes, no raisins. Other things to avoid would be garlic and onions. A little piece of garlic, a little bit of onion, probably not going to cause any trouble. But if your dog was digging up onions and eating whole onions or a whole, you know, bulb of garlic, we'd be in big trouble. So I'd just avoid those if you could. But yeah, if that's, they're kind of a low-cal fruit and you're getting to share them with your dog and you can share some with me. I love cherry tomatoes.
I do as well. And in fact, I'm thinking about my lunch for today.
Yeah.
And there's a big bag full of cherry tomatoes is kind of like about half my lunch for
there
the day.
There you go. Wow.
Wayne, thanks a lot for calling. You know, we had a caller earlier whose cat just would not drink water. And I, and you actually as well, we both wondered about the well water. And Rod in Weyerhaeuser said that he had the experience of a cat that drank well water, but when the well was re-drilled, the water flavor changed and the cat wouldn't eat it anymore.
Huh. Well, so, that's always possible, you know, and I tell people if they're going to be traveling across the country, same thing. I mean, if you've stopped at some of these waysides and so on, the water can be very irony tasting and they may not want to drink it. So always, you know, bring some from home if you can. So maybe it's time to, you know, try going to some bottled water or purified water to see if that makes a difference.
Joanne in Jacksonport. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I have a happy story again, too, and I think you recommended this. I had one of these short-haired black and white domestics that's fat and wails all the time like she's starving. And so I went to the muffin tin thing where you just put a few things in each cup, and it's just eureka. I can feed her less than her required amount for a while, and she's happy.
Yeah, it slows her down. I mean, and it's, it's kind of like, you know, if you have to, you know, walk around at a buffet with a tiny bowl or a tiny dish, you're only going to take a few things, and it's going to slow you down a little bit. That is, I love just use, everybody's got a muffin tin at home that, you know, doesn't get used as much. Just go ahead and do that. But there are some very cool interactive food bowls, containers, and things like that that are primarily made for dogs but work very well for cats. One that looks like a maze that they have to kind of paw the food through to get it out. Another one that looks like a bed of giant grass blades. If you just Google interactive pet feeders, all these things will come up. And but you know what? That muffin pan, that works for me. So thank you. Thank you for that feedback.
It's kind of an antique one, so that's even better.
Well, my cats get their canned food out of cut crystal bowls that I've picked up at an estate sale. So, you know, they have to have something pleasant to eat out of as well.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes.
Yeah.
Yep, that's right. Thank you. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Oh, Kim in Facebook says, my older cat goes upstairs and yowls at odd times of the day and night. I say something to her, she stops and meows normally.
Yeah, 15-year-old cat, I'd worry about cognitive decline, very common in the cat. Deafness, which can be very common too. And then the other thing you want to rule out is hyperthyroidism. Common problem in old cats, and they can become more vocal and just a little more agitated. And so those would be things to be looking into. But it's very possible that the cat has a little senility going on too.
And aspirin for dogs, just quickly, is you would not recommend?
I don't recommend it, although we do have a dose that we can use. It tends to be more ulcerogenic, meaning it irritates the stomach lining over some of the other drugs that we use that are labeled for dog use. And so if you are going to be using aspirin, check with your veterinarian regarding what dose to use. Use a buffered coated aspirin or something like Ascriptin, which is aspirin with Maalox to help coat the stomach, and be watching very carefully for stomach irritation. Always should be given with a meal and make sure you get the dose right.
Thanks, Sandy. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk will be back on October 8th, Tuesday, October 8th. Thank you for listening and stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.